Have you ever lost something and spent years looking for it? Maybe your car keys, maybe a favorite watch. Now imagine losing an entire squadron of warplanes under a glacier, and then spending more than a decade trying to dig one out. I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one is something else. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. It's July of 1942. The United States has been in the war for about 7 months. We're ferrying fighters and bombers across the North Atlantic to get them into the fight in Europe, and one of the routes runs through Greenland and Iceland, Operation Bolero, they called it. On this particular mission, a flight of 6 P-38 Lightnings and 2 B-17 Flying Fortresses are headed east. The weather turns bad. And I don't mean a little bumpy, I mean Greenland bad. Whiteout conditions, ceilings on the deck, no visibility at all, the flight leader makes the call. They can't continue, they need to turn back. But turning back doesn't work either because the weather has closed in behind them too. They're boxed in. Now remember, these P-38s don't have a lot of fuel to play with. They're ferry configured, sure, but they're burning gas, circling in soup, trying to find a way out. Eventually, every single airplane in that formation has to put down on the Greenland ice cap. All 8 of them, 6 Lightnings and 2 Fortresses, gear up, sliding onto the ice in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Now here's the remarkable part. Every crew member survived, 25 men out on the ice in the Arctic, and they all made it rescue teams, got to them over the following days, pulled them off the ice cap, and the airplanes were left behind. The military figured they'd come back for them, they never did, and the ice started to do what ice does. It buried them. Year after year, decade after decade, snow fell and compressed into glacial ice. And those 8 airplanes sank deeper and deeper. By the time anyone seriously thought about going back for them, those planes were under more than 250 feet of solid ice. Not snow. Ice. Enter a man named Pat Epps, along with his partner Richard Taylor. Pat was a businessman and aviator out of Atlanta, Georgia. He ran Epps Aviation at what was then DeKalb Peachtree Airport. Pat had heard the stories about the lost squadron, and in the early 1980s, he got it in his head that he was going to find those airplanes and bring at least one of them home. Now, a lot of people thought he was out of his mind, and honestly, looking at the logistics, you could see their point. But Pat Epps was not the kind of man who let a little impossibility slow him down. The first problem was just finding the planes. They knew the general area of the forced landing from wartime records. But the ice cap moves. It flows. Those airplanes hadn't just gone straight down, they'd drifted with the glacier. The team made multiple expeditions to Greenland through the 80s, using magnetometers and ground-penetrating radar, walking grids across the ice in brutal conditions. Wind chill that would freeze exposed skin in minutes. And for years, they came up empty. It wasn't until 1988 that they finally got solid radar returns. And what they found was sobering. The planes weren't at 50 feet, which they might have been able to manage. They weren't at 100 feet. They were at 268 feet below the surface. The ice had swallowed them whole. Now here's where it gets interesting. How do you get a 40-foot-long twin-engine fighter plane out of a hole that deep in a glacier? You can't just dig an open pit. The ice would collapse in on you. So the team came up with something called a Super Gopher. It was essentially a thermal device, a heated copper tube that melted its way down through the ice, creating a 4-foot diameter shaft. Think of it like a giant heated cookie cutter boring straight down into the glacier. They sent the Super Gopher down and hit the first airplane in 1992. And what they found was both heartbreaking and hopeful. The ice had crushed the airframe significantly. The B-17s were in bad shape, but one of the P-38s, number 222, was in recoverable condition. Bent, compressed, disassembled by the pressure of the ice, but the major structural components were there. The recovery itself was an engineering feat that could fill a whole separate episode. They had to disassemble the airplane piece by piece, 268 feet below the surface, working in a narrow shaft inside a glacier. The temperature down there was stable but cold, the lighting was artificial, and every piece had to be hauled up through that shaft to the surface, then transported across the ice to a staging area, then flown off Greenland by helicopter and cargo plane. It took months, multiple seasons of work, millions of dollars. And when they finally got all the pieces back to the lower 48, the real work began. The restoration was entrusted to a team in Middlesboro, Kentucky, and it would take another 10 years. Think about that. A decade of hands-on restoration work. The airplane had been underwater in a sense for 50 years. Corrosion had attacked every surface. The aluminum skins were pitted and warped. The engines had to be completely rebuilt. Much of the airframe had to be remanufactured from scratch, using original Lockheed drawings when they could find them and reverse engineering when they couldn't. The twin Allison V1710 engines were particular challenges. These are liquid-cooled V12 power plants, each producing about 1,200 horsepower. and they'd been sitting in ice water for half a century. The team sourced parts from all over the world. Other P-38 wrecks, surplus stocks, specialty machine shops, every gear, every bearing, every seal. The counter-rotating propellers were another puzzle. The P-38 used handed propellers, one turning clockwise and the other counterclockwise, to eliminate the torque effect. Finding the right props and rebuilding them to airworthy standards was a project within a project. The cockpit was rebuilt to original specifications. The instruments, the yoke, the throttle quadrant, all of it painstakingly restored or reproduced. The twin booms, which give the Lightning its distinctive look, had to be straightened and reskinned. The center nacelle, where the pilot sits between those two engines, was rebuilt practically from the ground up, and the paint scheme. They finished her in the olive drab and neutral gray of her wartime service with the nose art reading Glacier Girl, a name she'd earned the hard way. On October 26, 2002, Glacier Girl flew for the first time in 60 years. Rod Lewis was at the controls. The Allisons fired up and settled into that distinctive rumble that P-38 pilots from the war would have recognized instantly. Two big V-12s, synchronized, pulling a 38-foot wingspan through the air. Witnesses at the first flight said it was an emotional moment. Some of the people who had worked on the recovery and restoration had been involved for close to 20 years. Think about that kind of dedication. Two decades of your life poured into bringing one airplane back from the dead. Glacier Girl went on to become one of the most famous warbirds in the world. She flew the airshow circuit, appeared at Oshkosh, and became a symbol of what's possible when people refuse to give up on an airplane. Now, I want to step back for a second and talk about what this story really means, because it's not just about one P-38. There are fewer than 30 airworthy P-38 Lightnings in the world. Lockheed built about 10,000 of them during the war. 10,000, and we're down to a couple dozen that can still fly. Every single one that gets restored and put back in the air is a victory against time. It's a piece of history that roars to life instead of sitting behind a rope in a museum. And I've got nothing against museums, they do vital work, but there is something different about hearing those Allisons run, about feeling that exhaust wash over you on a flight line, about watching a 60-plus-year-old design cut across a blue sky and understanding in your bones what those young men flew into combat. The P-38 was Richard Bong's airplane. America's ace of aces, 40 confirmed kills in the Pacific, all of them in a Lightning. It was Tommy Maguire's airplane. Saint-Exupéry disappeared flying a P-38 over the Mediterranean. The Lightning did everything in that war. Photo reconnaissance, ground attack, long-range escort, night fighting. It was one of the most versatile airframes of the entire conflict. And Glacier Girl number 222, she never saw combat. She went into the ice on a ferry flight before she ever got to fire her guns in anger. But in a way, her story might be the most compelling of any P-38 that survives. Because she fought a different kind of battle, against ice, against time, against everyone who said she couldn't be recovered. Pat Epps passed away in 2023. He lived to see his impossible dream not only realized, but celebrated around the world. The airplane he pulled from under a glacier flew for more than 20 years on the airshow circuit. That's a legacy. I want to mention, if this story has you fired up, there are some wonderful resources out there. The Lost Squadron website has a detailed account of the recovery. There's a documentary called The Lost Squadron that follows the expedition, and if you ever get a chance to see Glacier Girl in person, do not pass it up. This one came together from a bunch of sources, including the Lost Squadron Project Archives and several accounts published in Air and Space Magazine over the years. You can find more stories like this at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Go find an airplane worth saving, and don't let anyone tell you it can't be done.